Good afternoon. It's Thursday, the 17th of May, 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, and myself, Brian Gerrish. And we're joined by Alex Thompson with Eastern Approaches. Of course, Alex reporting from the Netherlands. Well, we're back on air, Mike.
Yes. Yesterday, we were attacked once again. So this is about a week of pretty persistent attacks on the website. And other websites on the same server. We got it sorted out in the end, but certainly there was no access to the web to the website lunchtime yesterday.
So we can say this is professional.
It seems to be. I can't say for certain who's behind it.
Okay.
Probably ex-colleagues of Alex, I would have thought.
Possibly. And we have to say, of course, that we were also attacked for the NHS conference in Nottingham. We have reason to believe that staff from Open Democracy were behind that attack. So it appears that at the moment, UK Columns News is causing consternation with the government agencies. We'll leave it there.
Yeah. OK, well, let's get straight on then to, well, Theresa committing to EU military union. We've been warning about this. Of course, denials from the British government, the British military establishment that we're getting closer involved with EU military unification. But this is Theresa today at the EU Western Balkans summit in Sofia in Bulgaria. And she's meeting all the other 27 EU leaders. And she's going to tell them that, once again, she's going to tell them that the UK is committed to maintaining the EU's security in the long term. She says this year, as we mark the 25th anniversary of the diplomatic relations between Macedonia and the UK, the ties between our countries are stronger than ever. Next year, the UK is leaving the European Union, but we are not leaving Europe. We will continue to work with our allies, protecting our collective security and championing the European values that so many in Macedonia and the wider Balkans share. And so in that speech that she's going to give later on today, she's going to announce what some are describing as a bold vision for the UK's commitment to European security and the UK's place within that. So I'm looking forward to hearing that speech. Alex, what do you make of this continuing denial from the UK that we are going to be involved in unified military structures in the EU?
The thing it reminds me of, Mike, is Toynbee's speech in Denmark in the 1930s talking about the open conspiracy, something that actually goes back to H.G. Wells, who wrote a book of that title. And Toynbee's line in his 1930s speech is, denying with our lips what we are doing with our hands. At this stage, if you look at the Twitter accounts of any of the major crown ministers involved in European, particularly military unification, you will see that there are tweets posted under them by fairly reputable people now. Now I've noticed Trevor Coult, recipient of the Military Cross, and one of the key men of a new party, posting under, I think it was Tobias Elwood's Twitter feed, simply the tweet, I can see what you're up to and I know that you're rolling the country into EU military unification. So more and more people are using the correct language. The Continentals are not impressed by this either. There is agreement across the board in the Continental press now that nobody in the British government is being honest about their intentions. And there's increasing suspicion that the protestations that they're all incompetent, useless and know-nothing is perhaps a front for what's going on behind the level of the policy, of the Crown ministers at the level of the policymakers themselves.
Yes.
OK, well, let's add to that by bringing in this slide showing the NATO Defence College, Rome. They were tweeting out transatlantic link, field study, Brussels and NATO HQ with EU military, European Union military staff. So we'd hope to be able to speak with David Ellis yesterday. We couldn't do that, but this is one of the areas that he wanted to highlight. So as Alex has just indicated, this is going on in plain sight, but we can see that all the structure moving forward is to do with EU military unification, which includes the UK. But this is one of the other things that David Ellis wanted to point out is taking things back a step. This is the German Marshall Fund. Very interesting Twitter page and banner there, Mike, with a few of the great and good. Why was David Ellis interested in this? Well, here was Jens Stoltenberg, speaking. So we've got it under a NATO banner, but it's tweeted out by German Marshall Fund. Now, where does this bring us? This brings us back to the Marshall Plan after the Second World War. I'm sure Alex will be happy to comment on that. And if we're talking about the Marshall Plan, we're instantly talking about the people controlling billions and billions of dollars, pounds, any other currency, because this brings us back into the banks controlling politics. But let's follow through on the German Marshall Fund. And I was intrigued to see this, that they are good guys because they've got an alliance for securing democracy. So I encourage our viewers to go online and read this material for themselves and see what they think. And of course, if you're securing democracy, Mike, you've got to hammer the Russians because, of course, they want to overturn that democracy. So here is a whole section. This is a bit like the BBC and every other organisation that's hammering the Russians rolled into one. So we've got a silhouette sort of cartoon image of Putin top left. What is this organisation doing? Well, they're showing how Russian-linked accounts swarm online conversations in an effort to change or at the very least pollute online conversations that threaten the Kremlin or its allies. So it's well worth going and have a look at this. There's a whole machinery attempting to blame the Russians for virtually everything that's happening, be it US politics or the Western world. We always like to see who the people are. So you can also tune in to have a look at who the key faces are. We've got a Derek Chollet, Executive Vice President and Senior Advisor for Security and Defence Policy, Washington, D.C. So this is an independent, unbiased organisation, of course. And if you go to the Board of Trustees, I had to produce a little video clip to get them all in here. But what you will see is that they're all bankers, effectively. So German Marshall Fund, not surprisingly, banking interests at the back of it. And Alex, I think this is getting very clear that the Marshall Plan at the end of the Second World War, did it create an independent German state? Did it restore the sovereignty of Germany? Many people believe that the Germany we see is simply a controlled industrial unit of the former Allied powers.
That is now something of mass understanding in Germany, Brian. There's been no end of books about this. In fact, there's different persuasions of Germans writing about this. Some are called the Reichsbürger, the citizens of the Reich, and they have maybe a questionable cachet associated with them. But there's others who talk about the Souveränitätslüge, the lie of sovereignty. What this relates to is the three occupying Western powers, against their agreement with the Soviets, set up a Federal Republic of Germany in their own three occupation zones, plus the respective parts of West Berlin. And in response, the German Democratic Republic, the East German Communist State, was set up. Now, we all know that the German Democratic Republic was ultimately an arm's length state for the Soviet Union. But few people have assumed that the Bundesrepublik Deutschland, West Germany, was as much of a front for the Allies. But there's increasing evidence that this is so, from the tax regime through to who to own companies. In Germany, something that people started realizing in the 70s, and then more recently, Angela Merkel saying we didn't have sovereignty until a couple of years ago, so that would have been about 2011, and she said that we tidied up some loose ends so that we have sovereignty. It's coming out piece by piece. Researchers have even found and filmed an office which to this day exists in Frankfurt, which calls itself the Bundesrepublik Deutschland, with the letters after the German word, which equates to limited company. In other words, the Bundesrepublik Deutschland has been a holding shell for Western monies to flow in and out and for orders to be given. And it seems that the American, French and British controllers in 1949 told the Germans, you are going to get a 150-year lease in which you are suzerain, you know, under the sovereigns of the West. And in that framework, you do what you like. We're going to hopefully have some forthcoming articles exposing this, because some pretty senior people are now talking about it openly and in detail, and are saying it's time for the Germans to get off that Allied reservation and start making money more in a Eurasia-wide prosperity sphere, so defecting from us to the Russians and Chinese, and I don't think I blame them.
Thank you for that, Alex. And I think we can also say, if I got the title right, a book, Tell the Truth and Shame the Devil, written by Gerhard Menuhin, goes into this aspect in great detail. I'm still reading that particular book, but a lot of information about what was actually happening in Germany at the end of the Second World War and the immense control of the money powers. Okay.
Good news, Brian.
We're really pleased that we're going to be able to have the F-35 arriving in Marham in early June, which is 2 months ahead of schedule. This means that we're able to get the testing, we're able to do the work that's required in order to get the F-35 ready and in operations at the very earliest opportunity.
So that was our illustrious Gavin Williamson.
You had me worried. I initially thought, Mike, we were bringing back the Lancaster bomber to fill in the gaps with the RAF at the moment.
Honestly, I think the Lancaster would probably do a better job than the F-35. But anyway, Gavin says the F-35 is coming to our shores 2 months ahead of schedule. But where it's not going is onto the Queen Elizabeth. Well, why not? Well, let's have a look, because here is Defence Journal, I believe. Yes, I think it's Defence Journal. Now, Defence Journal is totally pro F-35. They despise anybody that criticises this fantastic aircraft at all. So as you would expect, this article particularly fawning over this this aircraft. But apparently, they now know why the F-35 trials aboard HMS Queen Elizabeth will be conducted by American jets flown by British pilots. The first jets that will perform F-35 trials aboard HMS Queen Elizabeth, they say, will be mostly American-owned but flown by British pilots. They say that they will belong to the Joint Operational Test Team. Now, the Joint Operational Test Team, Brian, I can't imagine what its purpose is, but apparently its purpose is to build confidence in the aircraft. Yes, so this is the flagship aircraft which needs confidence built in it, and we'll come on to why that is in a second. Now, what they say is the reason that most, if not all, the aircraft to touch down will be American isn't some scandalous outrage, brackets, just watch how some papers report this, though, but rather that most of the F-35Bs and Joint Operational Test Team are American, and that they understand that the UK have only 3 F-35s that are considered to be test jets that are, quotes, orange-wired, which takes data for post-flight analysis. Well, from what we understand, there's lots of data required for post-flight analysis because this aircraft continues to be non-functional in so many ways. News.com.au reporting day before yesterday that the F-35 stealth fighter deliveries restarted amid dispute over who pays for warranty fixes. And this is the United States in an ongoing dispute with Lockheed Martin involving the F-35. Because, of course, with there being so many problems with the aircraft, so many snags to fix, the question is who's going to pay for these fixes. Lockheed Martin wants the US and the UK governments to pay for the fixes. And the US government at least said, no, that's probably not appropriate because this thing's still under warranty. But this article says that who is responsible for the repair bill remains unknown. And the incomplete nature of many existing F-35 stealth fighters is reportedly presenting real issues for pilots training to fly the aircraft in combat, they say. And they say that the issues emerged in March when the need to make quality control fixes to some 200 F-35s already delivered was raised. So we were talking about the quality control issues with certain Royal Naval ships day before yesterday, yep. Brian. This seems to be running right through the military industrial complex. And I appreciate that this aircraft is a complex aircraft, but nonetheless, this project is having money thrown at it hand over fist. And it's really pretty embarrassing that we're in this state.
Well, it's happening with every project, Mike, because we've seen it with the submarine development projects, massive project cost increases. Of course, where's the money going? It's going into profit for the military-industrial complex is where it's going. But this aircraft is clearly disastrous. I don't think there's any other word to use at the moment. This aircraft does not perform. We haven't got it, so we've got these monstrous carriers coming online, no aircraft, and the Harrier's scrapped. Alex, is this Is this just incompetence, an accident within MOD procurement, or have we got something slightly more sinister going on?
With the amount of value for money and protocols that the MOD goes through to procure, I think there has to be something suspicious going on, because the US has been seeing reports about the various versions of the F-35, the problems. Our version is the F-35B, and that has particular problems with the oxygen purification system on board. But actually, far from seeing to rectification of these issues, what the Pentagon and our Ministry of Defense seem to be doing is to allowing these new systems to be rolled out onto the older fleet as well. So the Hornets, for example, have got problems with the oxygen on board, which they never used to have before. We have this from Joel Skousen, former Marine pilot, talking about it in his World Affairs brief and among others. So there seems to be a callous disregard, bordering on the treasonous, to put it mildly, about the performance of these airframes. And in this regard, David Ellis's reporting is second to none, because he talks about the banking interests, particularly the international ones at the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, which are determined that there should be massive players. Of course, the players are involved in the banks, these armaments companies, and that there should in the end be transcontinental armed forces, mainly for the purpose of a fantastic boondoggle, but secondarily to act as a world police and army, I think. So, you know, American viewers might think, well, we're insulated from this, but they're not, because as I was saying to a group of Americans that I was showing around Britain until yesterday, they have been deselected from the role of world policemen, and that function being repatriated to Europe, where the real old money and power is. So the F-35 is really just a way of spending a huge amount of money, and it's not even really airworthy.
Yeah. Well, let's add yet another part of this jigsaw, because UK column has warned about this for some time. We said that Devonport Dockyard would be closed. We've got more information coming in about this. And if we look at this base, huge base, the biggest naval base in Europe, 340 hectares, which is now mainly empty because, of course, the orange ships have gone, HMS Ocean shown in the insert. But the other thing we're getting information is that there's something very big about to blow with Rolls-Royce. We know there's been talk of 30% management cuts. And if you're cutting that amount out of your management structure, does that suggest to you maybe they haven't got the contracts? What would happen? Well, what we expect to see is Britain's defence industry subsumed largely into American interests, particularly Lockheed Martin.
That's why you would have management cuts if you're preparing for some kind of merger acquisition.
Yeah, merger. And of course, we have total silence on this issue from local MPs. Gary Streeter simply won't talk about what's happening, the devastation in Britain's military. Gary Streeter MP won't talk about it. Johnny Mercer MP, ex-army officer himself, said on one of the BBC interviews that he did recently that, of course, he didn't know what was going on inside the cabinet. So poor little Johnny, he's there at Westminster. He doesn't really understand what the big boys are doing, even though we can see what's happening, that the armed forces are being cut to pieces for EU military unification. And of course, this is not just a conservative thing, because we've got Luke Pollard, Labour, also refusing to talk about what's happening to the military. Astonishing.
Now, we intended to show this yesterday, but in yesterday's webcast that Ian Crane pushed out, he said this.
About 6 weeks ago, I was visited at the Misson Springs protection camp by a Lincolnshire undertaker who'd come to show his support for the anti-fracking community. And he made the observation, he said, Ian, I'm not sure whether this is sort of within your area of interest, but he said the undertaker community around the UK is becoming increasingly aware of a marked increase in deaths in England and Wales. And we had a conversation about it, and he couldn't really put a finger on why this was. But unfortunately, I didn't have the time to really follow up on this. But I'm pleased to say that there are academics that have. And it appears that a report was actually published in the British Medical Journal in March, alerting the readers to the fact that there has been some 20,000 additional deaths in the UK in the first 3 months of this year.
So that was from Ian's live stream yesterday. You can find that on his YouTube channel and also on his Facebook page. So here is the report that he was talking about. Rise in mortality in England and Wales in the first 7 weeks of 2018. It's been updated since. This was the graph that they were showing. They were comparing the average number of deaths per week in between 2013 and 2017 as an average, comparing that to what was going on in 2018. And you can see quite clearly there a marked step change in the rise in the number of deaths. Now, of course, they're not starting at zero. So let me show this, bring this up to date. That's the average in previous years between 2013 and 2017. And then if we add on the increase per week since the beginning of the year. Now, what the office, these figures are from the Office for National Statistics. And what the Office for National Statistics say is that for week one, that there is an effect from Christmas. I'm not quite sure whether that is that they expect there to be more deaths in the first week following Christmas because undertakers aren't working over the Christmas period. But nonetheless, the first week was the significantly fewer increase or smaller increase in deaths than appeared over the following weeks. And the two, week 13 and week 17 there, those 2 weeks were more or less identical to what had happened over the previous number of years, if you take the average. But as Ian said there, that is a total of 20,486 extra deaths this year than previously. And, you know, Ian was making a comment about an undertaker who had come to the fracking protection camp at Missing Springs to talk to Ian about this, or he discussed it with Ian. We're hearing this from other undertakers. So this is something which is not local to one particular area of the country. This seems to be spreading around. This is a representation of the collapse of the health service.
Well, it's a very sinister collapse, Mike. If people are dying in increasing numbers, which is what the statistics show, the effect around Christmas time is a known effect. It's very sad, but people who are isolated in particular find that a very bad time of year, so the deaths are known to increase. But one of the areas that Dr. Mark Jones, who spoke at our recent NHS conference in Nottingham, highlighted was the fact that we're mysteriously seeing an increase in deaths around the NHS financial end of financial year. So there seems to be death tying in with the whole financial profit making element, which has now come into the NHS as a result of privatisation. I'm sure Alex will want to come in here, but just follow through. This is Mechanics of Modern Murder. This is a diagram which Dr. Mark Jones has put out on his Twitter, and he talked about at the conference, where he is identifying how money and profit has come into the NHS and the wider care system, and how, and since the time this has been a driver, we're now seeing, sorry to be blunt, the bodies coming out of the system. And this was one of the other cartoons that he used. Cartoon on a very serious subject, but it does help to get what is happening. We've got people increasingly diagnosed with dementia for which GPs are being paid for. We had David Cameron saying that there was going to be 2 million people diagnosed with dementia. I think it was by 2040 or 2050. How did he know that? But of course, what we can see happening is dementia equals drugs treatment. And then these people are dying in very bad ways. They're dehydrated, emaciated. And Mark Jones says that he's also had undertakers telling him about their deep concern with the conditions of bodies. Now, some of this has been reported in a way in the mainstream press. So we've got the Daily Mail here commenting, and it's talking about the industrial approach to managing dying people. Well, if you play around with the words in that sentence a bit, you're really looking at the industrialized approach to getting rid of people. This is what seems to be happening. And the statistics we know are valid. We also know that Sir Brian Jarman was one of the many people who started to warn the government there was something strange happening with deaths. But of course, he was silenced after a common purpose team rewrote the Staffordshire Hospital investigation, and that was a common purpose team. That's what it was called. Now, if you have a look at this, that was kindly sent to us a couple of days ago, it's a court case, obviously the judiciary, England and Wales. So it's PW versus Chelsea and Westminster Hospital NHS Foundation Trust. And this is about a man who is now being cared for. He can only live with medical support and feeding by a gastric tube. The family wanted to take him home, but that was not going to be allowed. Viewers can freeze the screen and read all of the text here. So what was actually said is that the court said no. What the family want didn't matter, that it should be the decision of the court to decide what happened to this man. So we're seeing this more and more. If you think you are there to look after your loved ones, the British state says no, no, no. The state is going to decide on what happens to your children. Alfie Evans, the state is going to decide when your mum and dad die. So very serious stuff. And Alex, this in fact will lead us on to the Hofschreuer case, which I've got one slide for, but I don't know whether you'd like to comment on those very worrying statistics that we've just covered.
I would, yes. About a decade ago now, Common Purpose embedded in the register offices of various London boroughs, and they've since spun off under other names like Patchwork and FutureGov, but Common Purpose effectively started agitating and taking over the human resources departments of the London boroughs and the rest of the country in registration. And one of the things they got changed was the very unusual arrangement we have, even within common law countries, whereby register offices, don't confuse this with registrars in hospitals who are mid-range, mid-ranking doctors, registrars of births and deaths and the superintendent registrars above them who also conduct the marriages and keep the registers. These people, since the 1837 Act, have in all jurisdictions in the UK been statutory officers, or were until then. That means that the council's only job was to pay them, that they did not have control over them and boss them about. They were actually our public employees nationally. That did change in legislation at the end of the Brown Labour government or the beginning of the Conservative Liberal coalition government. I'm not sure whether that a change was extended to Northern Ireland and Scotland. I believe it was. I'm not entirely sure. But as a result of this, registrars, who are, of course, the other people who see all these dead people rising, and they see much more than the usual New Year peak, which happens with old people in the cold weather and the festivities and so on, that these are the only other people who are in the first line, or other than undertakers, of seeing what's happening. Undertakers, of course, are self-employed mostly, or work for private chains, whereas the registrars have now had their mouths stopped. Since a few years ago, under Common Purpose leadership, they have become employees of tightly run, tyrannical local councils. So it really is up to registrar whistleblowers, or more particularly, I think, to undertakers to point out what's going on. It's almost as if people knew several years ago that this was coming down the pipeline.
Mm. Yeah. So, Alex, this takes us into abuses in the psychiatric system. And I believe you've got an update for us on the Peter Hofschreuer case and, of course, his mother, Barbara.
I have, and I'll start by saying if people want to grab a pen, I'll give the two words they should search for in a moment to donate. But we've had a lot of this casework carrying on while I've been in Britain, and when I came back last night on the Eurostar, and this morning again, I've been chock-a-block with casework on this, but it's all good news because people's donations have now reached the level where we have been able, in Peter's name, to commission the human rights lawyer. I think it's best that we still keep his name confidential because there could be pressure put on that lawyer if it was known. This lawyer has taken a court psychiatrist's report. Again, I think I'll keep the name confidential, though I have put that name on the update, so it's public knowledge. This report overturns the sectioning order which Professor Manfred Waltzel used, and that he's alleged to have many thousands of victims. He does this for a living, it's claimed. So Waltzel had sectioned, i.e. put away in lifelong psychiatric care, Peter Hofschreuer, although he had never assessed him, and although an English court psychiatrist had written that he was perfectly sane. Now, finally, thanks to people's donations raised at various locations, such as the AV9 conference and others, we have now got to the stage where the appeal has been lodged within the deadline, Thank God for that. So Peter Hofstra's lawyer has put this appeal in. As part of it, the court psychiatrist's report has gone in, which I hope to put in an article as a translation. I've got the German original here on my desk. And it really goes to town on Waltzel, saying that he repeatedly goes beyond his professional capabilities and cites wrong-headed literature, claiming that Mr. Hofstra was a threat to society. And of course, this is a nonsense because he'd never been assessed. And so he ends by recommending that the verdict, or rather the sectioning order from the court, be overturned. So that's now in, awaiting a judgment from the appeal court in Austria. Meanwhile, your kind donations are still solicited for any ongoing expenses which the Peter Hofstra case in Austria may incur, and particularly also for the second cause which Peter requested the fundraiser was set up for, which is getting his very elderly mother, Barbara, who's 89, out of the forced care at York Social Services, for which an English barrister is needed. So we did it in the nick of time. There was an incredible number of problems with the money transfers. I don't think anyone was acting untoward, but I think that the whole chain of it is indicative of how it's almost impossible to do a fundraiser for people these days, because just a couple of thousand pounds or euros and you trigger some algorithm that suggests this is money laundering, and you then have to explain yourself in triplicate with photo ID to 15 people. And this goes on and on and on. We've persisted with it, thanks to the dogged persistence, particularly of the voluntary legal aid people in Vienna who go by the acronym SIM, and a guy called Markus Drexler, who's done great work for us, doing the casework, the legwork for the case, and providing it all to the lawyer. So it is all there. Now, here's the two words you can search in a search engine for to donate to Peter and Barbara's ongoing legal costs. That is Leechy, spelled L-E-E-T-C-H-I. And the second word is their surname, Hofstra. H-O-F-S-C-H-R-O-E-R. If you search for Leechy Hofstra, the first hit should be the leechy.com fundraising page where you can donate by credit card to that appeal. Thank you.
Yeah, excellent update. Thank you for that. And I'll just add that, of course, whilst progress is being made with Peter Hofstra, Melanie Shaw still in prison. And we know that that lady is still without a release date. So Theresa May, British Prime Minister, totally responsible in her former job as Home Secretary. But child abuse whistleblower Melanie Shaw still in prison, still being brutalised, and much work to be done there. Mike.
Right, let's move on to Ukraine. And the Russians opened the Kerch Bridge yesterday, much to the annoyance of many people in the West. This was the bridge, of course, that the Atlantic Council said would never be built, and if it was built, it would fall down straight away. Well, it hasn't fallen down. It's been opened, inaugurated, and so on. So this bridge, 19 kilometres long, whatever that is in real money, 15 miles or so, 14 miles, something like that, 40,000 vehicles it can carry, and 47 trains will be running on that every day. 14 million passengers, 13 million tons of cargo a year is what they say. What did the British say? Well, Alan Duncan said the opening of this bridge represents yet another violation of Ukraine's sovereignty and a further example of Russia's reckless behaviour. We continue to work with partners to oppose the annexation, including maintaining a robust package of sanctions. The UK also remains deeply concerned by the human rights situation in Crimea, where we have seen the systematic persecution of minority groups and of those who voice their opposition to Russia's illegal annexation of the territory. We call again for Russia to release all Ukrainian political prisoners held in Crimea and in Russia, and to allow unrestrained access for international human rights monitoring bodies in the peninsula. Well, can I just say to Mr. Duncan that perhaps we might want to see the release of UK political prisoners? I'm thinking the Skripals here. Who effectively seem to be just disappeared, and nobody seems to care about that, and perhaps allow some unrestrained access for international human rights monitoring bodies to get to see the Skripals.
I've got to say, wonderful irony here, Mike, isn't there, that building bridges has now become reckless behaviour.
Absolutely, absolutely reckless. Well, what did the Russians say about Britain? Well, they said, as for the relations between Russia and Great Britain, they are indeed at the worst level probably in history. Yeah. So that's where we're at with that. We don't need to worry because the Western press has got it nailed on the head. Here we go. Washington Examiner. Ukraine should blow up President Putin's bridge. This is the most unbelievable article I think I've ever seen in a mainstream media publication. Ukraine should now destroy elements of this bridge, is what the Washington Examiner says.
So inciting terrorism.
Inciting terrorism, absolutely. Now, who is editorially in charge of the Washington Examiner? Well, it's Hugo Gurdon, who has previously worked for the Daily Telegraph and the Guardian, and also for the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times. So this is the standard of media. We've got to blow up bridges and incite acts of war.
Is he going to get a visit from Homeland Security for inciting terrorism?
You may well ask. I'm going to say no better time to have the media on trial event, which is asking this very question, really, at the end of the day. This is unbelievable. Alex, this is just unbelievable rhetoric from a mainstream publication.
I think this is flagrant breach of every international treaty going back to the Peace of Westphalia of 1648, and particularly, I think, the Vienna Convention, because, you know, states are not supposed to advocate. I know that Washington Examiner is not a state, but there are others in the civil services of governments who are doing this, advocating the destruction of infrastructure in third countries, never mind the question of whether international law is decisive on whose territory the bridge crosses, destroying infrastructure. I mean, even if you say it's international waters for some of it, then we get into the realms of piracy, which until the Blair amendments, of course, to our constitution, piracy and destroying Her Majesty's dockyard, something we're also now seeing, were the most capital of capital offences and the last to have the death penalty removed from them. So this is advocating piracy, war and murder.
Absolutely. Now, of course, the news the day before yesterday was about the opening of the US embassy in Jerusalem. Well, Guatemala has now followed suit, and they have opened their embassy in Jerusalem. This follows on from a UN resolution, really. A number of countries had sort of expressed an interest in moving their embassies to Jerusalem. So aside from the United States, Guatemala, Honduras, Marshall Islands, Micronesia, Nauru, Palau, and Togo. So all really big countries. Israel must be proud to have that support.
Do you think
there.
They might have been given a little bit of a financial incentive
always,
to do that? Right?
It's always possible, but you know, it's a bit sad that all that Benjamin Netanyahu can, aside from his friends in the United States, all that Benjamin Netanyahu can the only countries he can get support from are other tin pot.
Smaller countries.
Smaller countries, yes. But anyway, that's that. Alex, just give us 2 seconds on your thoughts on what's been going on in Gaza and this whole issue of the recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
On the second of those, the recognition, this is a precise mirror image of when the West very much mocked the Russian Federation after it recognized Abkhazia and South Ossetia as territories independent of Georgia following the war in summer 2008, because the countries that followed suit were Nauru, which took a bribe for it, of course, as they did this time the other way round, and Nicaragua, as far as I recall, and I think there was a fourth one that came in later. And this was mercilessly mocked by the Americans and Europeans as evidence that Russia basically had bought people off diplomatically. China and Taiwan do the same thing with these Pacific Island states as well. And now we're doing it, or at least the US is, and we're supposed to take it seriously. As regards Gaza, this is an extremely serious and troubling issue, of course. A lot of people, particularly in my neck of the woods online, as Christian conservatives, are very split between their sympathy for the idea of a Jewish state and the reality of what's going on in Gaza. I cannot take seriously the convictions of many Christians and friends of Israel that everyone protesting behind the fence in Gaza was Hamas supporters. That makes no sense to me at all. And I think Mr. Galloway, much as I disagree with him on many points, has rightly gone into overdrive on this on his talk radio show the last couple of days, because the people who were shot with, you know, bone-crushing bullets and all kinds of heavy stuff, gas, they were hundreds of yards behind the line, and they included people sheltering in tents. So you cannot call this a Hamas protest, really. This is the people of Gaza.
Well, in fact, in a massive own goal, I noticed that the Israelis managed to fly a drone over a bunch of journalists and drop tear gas on them right in front of the cameras. So You know, it's spectacular what's going on there. But let's move back to the UK and civil society. Now, lots of people complained about the image of Matthew Hancock that I insist on using. So I had to choose a different one. But this is from an event he was speaking at yesterday. He was talking about civil society, and he said the essence of civil society, one reason it has such strong roots in this country, is freedom, apparently. And Matthew Hancock wants to preserve and extend the independence of the sector in two ways. First of all, he wants to see it develop in a more sustainable operating model. And second, he wants to see civil society recover its confidence to speak in our public life. The greatest social and political changes in our history, he said, have come about because independent people formed associations to press for change. If that means respectful criticism of government, so be it. So civil society is allowed to criticise government, so long as it does it respectfully, Brian. Okay. But he went on to say, and I say that very deliberately, it's true that like most ministers, I don't want charities spending their time or even taxpayers' money pursuing narrow ideological or political crusades against the government. Well, that's a bit strange because the government spends taxpayer money pursuing narrow ideological and political crusades against the people. So I don't see what the problem is.
Well, they're allowed to do it because, of course, Parliament, according to them, is sovereign. They can do what they like.
Absolutely right. But then he goes on to say that could be that would be wrong. It is natural for me to say that, but I don't think you should stick to your knitting either, if indeed any of you know how to knit. The business of civil society is society, and within the limits of charity law, you have the right to campaign, to persuade the public, and to press for change in the systems which affect the life of this country. But I also think there's a flip side. If civil society is entitled to its views, so too is government. You need freedom and you need clarity from what government wants to do and how we intend to work with you. And that is what civil society strategy will set out. So he said, of course, government, central and local, government itself is a major funder of civil society. I have added that last bit, which is why you're independent, because, of course, civil society increasingly isn't independent. It is working with government, and that's why he said, and how we intend to work with you. He said, this runs through everything we're doing in the civil society strategy. I want to give young people a meaningful stake, so he wants to target the young. And then he goes on to target Facebook. Facebook has done everything right over the last decade. It has acquired 2 billion customers. It has created profit, however, a profit, however, the likes of which the world has never known, but it doesn't have a social purpose. And this is the point here. He goes on talking about how businesses need to have a social purpose. And the event itself, the Civil Society in the 21st Century event, this was one of the questions. Given the social purpose revolution, isn't all of society becoming civil society? And my question was, what is the social purpose revolution? It's not one that's sort of at the top of the mainstream media's sort of catchphrases at the moment.
I'm just going to say, Mike, this is big society. This is what Cameron was unleashing. This is the hive. This is bringing everything together, interlinked, so that there is no such thing as a free individual.
Absolutely, absolutely. So the social purpose revolution is all about companies having a social purpose, a change agent. The corporations themselves become agents of change and bring the whole infrastructure of the corporation to the purpose of social change. Well, we can get more from this book, for example. This is a book that they're proposing. I'm not proposing that people read this book, but it's there if you want to read it. The Purpose Revolution, How Leaders Create Engagement and Competitive Advantage in an Age of Social Good. Wow. So what we have here, Alex, is £40 billion being spent on the charity sector in this country already. And now we're going to get billions more added to that through corporations apparently suddenly creating a social conscience and becoming purposeful in their activities, driving social change. With all this charity and social change going on, it's a wonder that they need to be driving homeless people off the streets of Windsor.
Or indeed, to go back to the Church of England, which you reported on in the last item, Brian and Mike, or the last broadcast, it's remarkable that the dioceses, which have their own registered charity numbers these days, are getting all the fat of the land, literally, because, of course, the Church Commission has held great land endowments while the parishes, the poor and missions are having to be self-funding, they're told. So the same asset stripping model is being rolled out much further. Now, this is very remarkable. And civil society, as usual, the Brits do a slight turn of phrase to mask their intentions. It's what in the US would be called communitarianism or community organisers. And as Gilad Atzmon says it in his inimitable way, it is people speaking as a. You know, you don't go to your member of parliament, who is hard to see these days, and say, I am Mr. X and I require you to change this. No, you have to turn up to some big tent event and say, as a disabled black woman, or whatever your category is, and then you'll have that taken forward and you'll be spoken for by a large, big society organisation.
Yeah.
OK, well, we're watching the clock, but let's squeeze in a little bit on, well, what is it? The royal wedding. We had to do it. So big news here is that Elton John will perform, but if you read the article, he says he may perform, but maybe he's going to think about performing. If you don't know who he is, well, here's another nice picture of him. I'm just going to label this the state of the nation, because with all of the problems this country's got at the moment, mainstream media seems to think these people are still key role models for us. So the royal wedding, well, the great and the good and Elton John possibly going to be there. Meanwhile, on the streets, the police are rounding up the homeless because we don't want homeless people soiling the event. I find this just an outrageous statement of what the UK has become under Labour, Lib Dem and Conservative governments. I find this really horrific. I will certainly not be watching anything at all to do with the royal wedding. I have much better things to do. Don't know where you want to go from there, Mike, whether you want to just come in a bit on the BBC.
Oh, absolutely do. I came across this morning. Here we have Lisa Robinson from BBC Media Action, according to this tweet, talking about the need for an enabling environment and trust in risk information. And this was at the UR 2018 conference. Now, what is UR? Well, it's all about understanding risk. Here it is. And they say UR is a global community of 8,000 experts and practitioners active in the creation, communication and use of disaster risk information. Members share knowledge and experience, collaborate and discuss innovations and best practice in risk assessment. The community convenes every 2 years at UR forums, 5-day events that highlight groundbreaking work, facilitate non-traditional partnerships and showcase new technical know-how in disaster risk identification. So this is all about identifying disaster risks and making sure that it's communicated properly. But I was just interested, the BBC Media Action was at an event like this. You would expect NGOs like David Miliband's International Rescue to be at events like this. But BBC Media Action clearly involved in the communication section. So I went looking for Lisa Robinson, and first place I found her was in the Soul Beat African Network. This apparently convenes the African Communication and Media Development, Social and Behaviour Change Community. So here we've got BBC Media Action once again in the social change, behavioural change in Africa this time. And the Soul Beat Africa Network, they say about themselves that they're a collaboration between the Soul City Institute for Health and Development Communication and the Communication Initiative, offers a space to access and share knowledge as well as network around a wide range of development issues with focus on media and communications for social change in Africa. So that's good stuff. And they're pointing out that Lisa Robinson will also be speaking on the same subject at the Third World Conference on Disaster Risk Reduction. So that's fantastic. BBC Media Action said, have you used social media or communication to help communities at risk become more aware of disaster risks and build their resilience? And this issue of resilience, Brian, is something which is being driven through. It's a global agenda. It's being driven through in the UK. It's being driven through from the parish council level right up to the city level and city region level. But it's something which is being pushed right through across the world.
Pushed across the world, and we just remind people that BBC Media Action, of course, boasted that it had helped destabilise Syria. So they were pretty well up on the risk because they were helping create the risk.
Absolutely. So sticking with the BBC now, thanks to Ned Pamphilon for these images, brilliant graphics. On the right, we've got BBC Trending's Mike Wendling. And of course, why were we interested in BBC Trending and Mike Wendling in particular? Because he had carried out one of the attacks on Vanessa Bailey, Piers Robinson, Tim Hayward and Patrick Henningsen. And so I wanted to know a little bit more about BBC Trending, what it was, what sort of budget it has, how many people and these kind of things. So I put in a Freedom of Information request and I asked very simply, I asked, please provide an organisational chart or structure for BBC Trending, including senior managers' names. Please also provide a breakdown of BBC Trending's budget and funding sources. Now, I wasn't assuming that BBC Trending was receiving all its money from the licence fee, because there is other money comes into the BBC, but that was what I asked. And this was the BBC's response. Under Section 1.1 of the Freedom of Information Act, we can confirm that the BBC does not hold any information in regards to your request. Due to the size and changing nature of the BBC, we do not have an organisational chart for the area that you asked for. So it's now absolutely clear to me, Brian, why the BBC requires a £3.8 billion budget every year, because they don't know who they've got working for them, they don't know how much they're getting paid, and they don't know what the budgets are, and they don't know how they're working together or what they're working on. So clearly, under those circumstances, you do need billions of pounds just to make sure that everybody's happy.
Yes, I've got a theory on why it works like that. But Alex, would you just like a few seconds as we close?
That sounds very much like the European Union you've just described, Mike. The same amount of, well, no, not the same amount, but the same concept of billions flushing around. Nobody can audit it. Nobody knows who works where. Lots of masquerading, lots of foreign interests, ghostwriting reports to be signed off by name-recognised officials. So no doubt that Ned Panflian is right to, in his cartoon there, to have called the BBC the Brussels Broadcasting Corporation. I think they're two peas in a pod.
Absolutely.
Thank you for that. Well, we'll end there and say thank you to all our audience today for joining us. We have gone out live, which is good. And thank you also to the people who've made some donations, the Woodsman in particular. So thank you for that. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.